far-right candidates are threatening to run away with April's presidential election largely on immigration-related issues. Macron continues to retain a hardcore base of support of around 20% of voters. While that may be enough to put him into the second round, many wonder if he will become the nation's third consecutive one-term president. As post-Brexit Europe settles into hardened reality, issues both minor and major may become over-politicized with increasing regularity. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
The Zol Party's conference is convened in the commercial hub of Pakistan to condemn the UK's move of declaring Hamas a terrorist organization.
Participants of the conference stressed on the need for unity among Muslims and called on the international community to take serious notice of what they call the unilateral action of the old colonial power, the UK, who gave birth to the Zionist regime in the heart of Muslim world.
The conference was organized by Palestine Foundation of Pakistan, aiming to launch further series of week-long activities across the country.
We are all very much disturbed because of the United Nations and the United States policies about the Palestine and about the Israel. Israel is killing Muslims in all over the Palestine, and they are burning the houses and the colonies of the Muslim and building up the colonies for the Jews.
It's a clear nonsense because, you know, the Hamas is the only representative of the Palestinian. All the organizations, they are represented by the peoples. They do not involve in terrorism. The UK and Australian have their own terrorist organization, which was supported by UK. Our terrorists from Karachi is in UK, and they were giving the shelter to them. So this is a nonsense, and we do not accept that, and we condemned it.
The UK's move in November coincided with Balfour Declaration in 1917, when British colonial imperialist power created the Zionist apartheid.
Actually, Israel is defeating. Israel will be no more in the map of world in nearby future. So that's why their creator, especially British government and the United States administration, they are worried.
Participants called on the Prime Minister Imran Khan to do more than mere condemnation of the UK's government, that instead of apologizing and correcting its historical wrongs across the world and against the Palestinian people, is supporting the aggressor both in Kashmir and Palestine. Mohammad Turi, Karachi.
The 23rd Mediterranean Exchange of Archaeological Tourism has wrapped up in Paestum, a site in central southern Italy recognized by UNESCO as part of the World Cultural Heritage. The three-day initiative aimed to promote sites and destinations of great archaeological value and increase business opportunities. Some 100 conferences and meetings took place during the international event that has seen the participation of more than 150 exhibitors from 15 countries. Syria was among them, with a stand presenting the current state of the Palmyra World Heritage Site in the Homs province after the destruction by Daesh.
In 2015, Daesh militants seized the modern town of Palmyra first and then ancient ruins nearby. The militants initially promised to leave the sites, temples and columns untouched. However, those promises went on to be unfulfilled.
Daesh attacked Palmyra's archaeological sites with bulldozers and explosives until 2016. The region of Palmyra was then freed from Daesh by a coalition of Syrian-Russian military forces on March 24, 2016. During the Mediterranean Exchange of Archaeological Tourism, an International Archaeological Discovery Award for the most valuable discovery of the year was assigned. The award is named after Khaled al-Assad, the archaeologist of the site of Palmyra who was brutally murdered by Daesh for trying to protect the cultural heritage. Max Civili, Paestum.
In an event event in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, Yemen's Prime Minister Abdulaziz bin Habtour honored the Press TV for its prominent role in standing by the Yemeni people and exposing the crimes of the Saudi led coalition since the beginning of the war.
I would like to thank Press TV and its crew for standing by the Yemeni people in the face of the war imposed on us. Press TV reveals the truth about the war that has taken place between the axis of resistance and the U.S. proxies in the region. Sana'a is just one of the front lines of this confrontation. We greatly appreciate every effort made by satellite channels that honestly expose the crimes of the Saudi-led coalition and reveal the suffering of Yemenis to the world amid the continuing war and siege imposed by Saudi Arabia.
Participants said the Press TV has always been supporting the Yemeni people and its major role is clear through its continuing existence in the field to keep pace with the advancements of the Yemeni army and the Saudi violations against Yemenis.
Press TV is one of the leading channels that serves as a role model for free media and contributes to the resistance of the Yemeni people. This channel has had a prominent impact on Yemenis by keeping pace with every event, whether the victories of the Yemeni army or the crimes of the Saudi-led coalition. So Press TV deserves to be honored and appreciated by the Prime Minister.
Since the beginning of 2015, Yemenis have been suffering under war and siege imposed by Saudi Arabia. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and says millions of Yemenis, including children, are on the brink of famine.
Observers say Saudi Arabia has used thousands of media outlets to spread its propaganda and mislead the free people of the world about its war crimes in Yemen. Therefore, as observers say, the resistance media outlets should stand together against the Saudi-led coalition media war. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Iran's representative at the International Atomic Energy Agency addresses a virtual session of the IAEA's Board of Governors. Mohammad Reza Qaebi says the Islamic Republic's first priority at the upcoming talks to revive the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA will be the effective and verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions without any further delay and any preconditions.
The principal position of the new government of the Islamic Republic of Iran is that the first priority and issue that should be considered seriously into consideration is removal of all illegal sanctions imposed against Iran after the withdrawal of the U.S. from the deal.
Qaebi said the U.S. needs to address concerns arising from its 2018 withdrawal from the agreement, the least of which is how its possible future adherence can be relied upon. Iran has also criticized European states for requesting that Tehran implement its commitments under the deal, saying that until sanctions are not removed, it's not reasonable to expect more forbearance from the country. During the previous rounds of talks on reviving the JCPOA, Iran made it clear it wanted all U.S. sanctions, including additional ones imposed under the previous administration of Donald Trump, to be removed. Up until now, Tehran says, the administration of Joe Biden has not only failed to mitigate the U.S. maximum pressure policy, but has actually exacerbated it. Delegates from Iran, the three European states of Britain, France, Germany, plus Russia and China, are expected to resume negotiations on Monday here at Vienna's Hotel Coburg, the same venue where talks to reach the nuclear agreement concluded more than 6 years ago. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah denounced Australia's decision to list the whole group as a terrorist organization, saying it was, quote, a humiliating submission to American and Zionist dictates. In a statement, Hezbollah stressed that such a move will not affect its determination to support any anti-Israeli movement.
The timing is bizarre. The only thing that points to the timing is the visit by Israeli diplomats to Australia. That means that the Australians are abiding by a request by the Israelis. That is what this decision is all about. These are the indicators. Now, what repercussions does this decision have? I think that the Australian diplomats, and let me break out, break it out to you, the Australian diplomats have been trying in the back door to have to be in touch with Hezbollah to actually say that there are no repercussions.
Australia on Wednesday extended a pre-existing ban on the movement's armed units.
The group continues to threaten terrorist attacks and provide support to terrorist organisations. Hence my intention to list the entirety of Hezbollah.
Observers believe the United States has been exerting all efforts with its allies to demonize Hezbollah, not only in the region, but across the globe.
It seems clear that the U.S. is facing a dilemma in the region, which is Hezbollah, and it is attempting to deal with this dilemma through a political course with Lebanon, in the region and beyond it. When we see that Australia takes such a decision, we can conclude that the U.S. is using all its arms and its tools in all spheres to face Hezbollah in a medium and long-term track.
Analysts agree that this comes only months preceding the Lebanese parliamentary elections in order to intimidate expats from going to the ballots, while it also puts pressure on Hezbollah's allies at home. Sources close to Hezbollah also expect to see similar moves from countries which have taken the U.S. path in their foreign policies. Hezbollah has long been targeted by the U.S., Israel, and their allies, but Hezbollah is a fully functioning political party within the Lebanese parliament and cabinet, and many fear that the recent move by Australia could impact diplomatic ties with Lebanon's government and further destabilize the country. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The Palestinian Center for Human Rights, along with UNRWA and the Palestinian Ministry of Public Works, held a workshop in the Gaza Strip to discuss Israel's latest destruction of hundreds of buildings during the May War. According to the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, over 100,000 internally displaced persons, or IDPs, sought shelter and protection at UNRWA schools or with hosting families. Currently, there are still about 8,000 Palestinian IDPs, primarily those whose houses were completely destroyed or severely damaged during the one-ton Israeli bombardment.
The Israeli war in May caused massive destruction, especially to residential areas, and thousands of families have been internally displaced. The delay of reconstruction is a direct result of the Israeli blockade. Israel bans the entry of building supplies into the Gaza Strip in a direct and grave violation of the international law and the Fourth Geneva Convention.
People and businesses in the Gaza Strip are still waiting for the reconstruction to start. In addition to bombing thousands of buildings and infrastructure, Israeli regime forces also killed hundreds of innocent civilians, including women and children.
It was 7 p.m. on the last day of the holy month of Ramadan when the apartment building where I lived was bombed. Israeli warplanes first fired a drone rocket and minutes later hit the building with an F-16 bomb. My family is currently displaced and we are just lucky to be still alive. We call on all the world to help us rebuild our homes.
Over 2,200 Palestinians were also injured during the Israeli air raids, including 685 children and 480 women, some of whom may suffer a long-term disability requiring rehabilitation. Hundreds of Palestinian families have lost everything during Israel's May onslaught, and their plight has no end in sight.
My house was bombed on the morning of Eid al-Fitr around 5 a.m. It was a horrific scene beyond description. Can you imagine being with your wife and children preparing for the holiday, and all of a sudden your house is bombed and no longer have a place to call home?
Many Gazans had their lives shattered because of the recent war, and they still have no proper place to raise their families. Rights groups accused donor countries of failing to fulfill their financial pledges to rebuild the tiny coastal territory and end the illegal and inhumane Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
With countries trying to close their doors to the new coronavirus variant, Southern African officials note that the West's hoarding of vaccines helped create their struggle in the first place. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Benjamin Muller, Declan Walsh, and Jason Horowitz. The piece is titled, As Omicron Variant Circles the Globe, African Nations Face Blame and Bans. Nations in Southern Africa protested bitterly on Saturday as more of the world's wealthiest countries cut them off from travel, renewing a debate over border closures from the earliest days of the coronavirus pandemic and compounding the problems facing poorly vaccinated countries. A new coronavirus variant called Omicron, first detected in Botswana, put governments on edge after South Africa announced a surge of cases this week, plunging countries into the most uncertain moment of the pandemic since the highly contagious Delta variant took hold this spring. As in the early days of Delta, political alarm spread quickly across the world, with officials trading blame over how the failures of the global vaccination effort were allowing the virus to mutate, even as researchers warned that the true threat of the new variant was not yet clear. Bearing a worrying number of mutations that researchers fear could make it spread easily, Omicron was spotted on Saturday, 27th of November, in patients in Britain, Germany, and Italy, leaving in its wake what scientists estimated to be thousands of cases in Southern Africa and tens or hundreds more globally. One nation after another shut its doors to Southern Africa, even as they spurned public health measures that scientists said were far more urgently needed to take on the new variant. Australia, Thailand, and Sri Lanka were among the latest countries on Saturday, 27th of November, to join the United States, Britain, and the European Union in banning travelers from South Africa and all nearby countries. Health officials in the Netherlands on Saturday, 27th of November, announced that 61 passengers on two flights from South Africa had tested positive for the virus, the latest indication of how difficult it might be to stop the variant from crossing international borders. The decade of travel closures triggered a wave of resentment among Africans who believed that the African continent was yet again bearing the brunt of panicked policies from Western countries, which had failed to deliver vaccines and the resources needed to administer them. Richer nations, having already hoarded vaccines for much of 2021, were now penalizing parts of the world that they had starved of vaccine shots in the first place, according to scientists. Told you so, said François Vonter, a researcher at University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, South Africa, referring to warnings from African researchers that delaying vaccinations there risked the emergence of new variants of the coronavirus. It feels like these rich countries have learned absolutely nothing in terms of support. The sense of outrage was most visceral in South Africa, where business leaders predicted a dire economic toll, especially on tourism. In the arrivals hall of Johannesburg's O.R. Tambo International Airport, Ronald Masiwa, a tour operator, watched with dread as the information board flipped to red, displaying cancellation notices. Three clients had already cancelled trips overnight, and he feared that many more would follow. Some health officials said that the travel bans may buy some time to figure out how to deal with this new variant. But just as border closures a year ago did little to stop the spread of an earlier coronavirus variant from Britain, scientists said the latest travel shutdowns and restrictions had likely come too late. Scientists worried that the restrictions would discourage other nations from reporting variant cases out of fear of being slapped with travel bans and restrictions. Border closures have provoked debate during a succession of public health crises, including the Ebola virus outbreak in 2014, with global health officials warning that such bans can interrupt the flow of medical supplies and do economic damage that makes countries reluctant to report health threats. The chaotic introduction of the closures in Amsterdam on Friday, 26th of November, left some 600 passengers on two flights from South Africa crammed into planes and then unventilated rooms for about 30 hours. Those who avoided hotel quarantines by testing negative scattered to other destinations after receiving results around 3 a.m. on Saturday, 27th of November. You close down the boundary with Africa, then you close the boundary with Belgium, then you close the boundary with somewhere else, said Alessandro Wispignani, a Northeastern University professor who has studied travel restrictions from early 2020 and advised government agencies in recent days on responses to the latest variant. But every time you close it, it's a little late. It remains unclear whether the Omicron variant will transmit as easily as global health officials fear. The variant may simply have been in the right place during a surge of new infections in South Africa, making it appear more contagious than it really is. But experts said the border closures would wreak havoc in African countries that were counting on reopening. In South Africa, December is traditionally the high season for tourism, one of the country's biggest industries, and operators had been banking on a surge in visitors from Britain, which had removed South Africa from its red list only last month. "This is devastating," said David Frost, chief executive officer of the Southern Africa Tourism Services Association. "Many companies have been hanging on by their fingernails, and this is going to wipe them out. It's going to be dire for conservation, and it's going to be dire for people in rural areas, where tourism is the only economic generator." South Africa's number of daily infections, 2,828, on Friday, 26th of November, was a small fraction of case counts in countries with similarly sized populations, like Germany and Britain, not to mention the United States. For David Frost, the hurried measures were the mark of a blatant double standard. "Just over 10% of people in Africa have received one dose of the vaccine, compared with 64% in North America and 62% in Europe." For the countries imposing travel bans, scientists said, far more consequential than delaying the arrival of the new Omicron cases was the question of what they would do with whatever time they had bought themselves to respond. At home, scientists said, those countries should ramp up testing and vaccinations and help infected people isolate, especially given the difficulties they were already having containing the Delta variant of the coronavirus. Scientists pleaded with countries to match their efforts globally, including with aid to Southern Africa for their health systems and vaccination and variant tracking efforts. "If all we do is a travel ban and we don't increase testing at airports or provide resources for people to isolate if they do test positive so they can justify missing work, all of that would have to be happening to reduce community transmission," said Joseph Fowler, an assistant professor studying genomic surveillance at the University of Nebraska Medical Center in the United States. After decades of skepticism towards border closures among global health officials, COVID-19 forced experts to re-examine their views, said Alexander Phelan, a professor studying global health policy at Georgetown University in Washington. Alexander Phelan says, "We gained a bit of nuance and realized that travel restrictions have a potential role to play in slowing the spread of a new respiratory disease, even though it doesn't stop it," she said. Still, Dr. Vespignani and his colleagues have shown that even the strictest travel restrictions only modestly delay the spread of the virus without other efforts to cut transmission. And whereas countries had some hope in early 2020 of tracing the contacts of patients from abroad, sequencing the virus takes too long to allow health officials to pick out people infected with the Omicron variant for special containment measures. "They get dispersed in a sea of thousands and thousands of infections," Dr. Vespignani said, "of any new cases of the Omicron variant. It's a very, very tough situation." The latest variant has already shown signs of spreading locally beyond southern Africa. A patient in Belgium, for instance, had no connections with southern Africa, having traveled recently to Egypt, according to officials. Several scientists said they suspected that the variant had been spreading undetected in countries with lackluster sequencing efforts before it surfaced in Botswana and in South Africa, giving it more time to scatter globally. Nevertheless, European nations did not find the variant until after South Africa alerted them to it, demonstrating the gaps in their own surveillance efforts. The variant had plenty of opportunities to spread. In November, there were 334 flights scheduled out of southern Africa into Europe with a capacity of nearly 100,000 seats. And three dozen flights were scheduled from Johannesburg into the United States this month. In the United States, health officials say they are better equipped to track variants than earlier in the pandemic. Scientists can identify the Omicron variant with a standard nasal swab test, giving them a leg up in tracking the spread of the variant. But the United States is suffering so many daily infections that many samples are being overlooked, and there are pockets of the country where relatively few cases are being sequenced.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of internet.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the Economic Cooperation Organization, known as ECCO, has convened in Turkmenistan. The 10 members of the organization have reiterated their commitment to increase relations with each other. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi addressed the summit and stressed how it is Tehran's goal to have good relations with all of its neighbors. And despite increased pressure of U.S. sanctions, enhancing relations with its neighbors will not be impeded. Well, stay with us as we take a look at all this may mean on the Spotlight.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has attended the 15th summit of the Economic Cooperation Organization in Turkmenistan. Addressing the one-day summit on Sunday, he assured Iran's neighbors that Washington's sanctions will have no bearing on regional cooperation and interaction. The United States' cruel sanctions against Iran will not have the slightest impact on the Islamic Republic of Iran's policy of maximum interaction with neighboring and regional countries.
Raisi called on member states to work together in a range of fields, from the creation of a regional electricity market to water transfer projects, as well as energy ventures. He also proposed creating an internal financial mechanism by the Economic Cooperation Organization to boost its efficacy. On the sidelines of the summit, Raisi held a string of high-level bilateral meetings to discuss ways to develop relations. The Iranian president has time and again said boosting cooperation with neighboring countries is one of the major goals of his administration. He believes that approach will help improve economy as well as peace and stability in the region. Iran took a big step in this regard in September when it formally became a full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. That's a Eurasian political, economic, and security alliance, accounting for about one-third of the world's land and exporting trillions of dollars in goods annually. Recently, Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Kani traveled to several regional countries, including Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, and Oman, for talks on expanding bilateral cooperation. This month, he also went to four European countries, namely France, Germany, Britain, and Spain, where similar talks took place. Bagheri Kani's European tours came ahead of talks set to begin Monday in Vienna. The talks taking place between Iran and other remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal aim to remove sanctions on Tehran. Those sanctions took effect after the U.S. left the nuclear deal in 2018 as part of its so-called maximum pressure campaign, seen as an attempt to isolate Iran in international arena. More than 3 years into that policy, it seems that it has failed, with Iran expanding ties with countries in the region and beyond while being accepted by more international bodies.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the spotlight, Mostafa Khoshchesh, journalist and political commentator out of Tehran. And John Bosnich, journalist and political analyst.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me on the program. Let's start it off with Mostafa. How important is this Economic Cooperation Organization in enhancing trade and mutual interests for member countries?
Thanks for coming me.
Thank you for coming.
Very important because member states are neighboring countries, with lots of shared interests, common interests, and common interests. If they enhance their ties, you know, in various areas of economy, politics, and security, because of these common interests and threats, their interests would go more interwoven with each other, and they could help each other. It could bring about, you know, peace by removing misunderstandings, adding up, the capacities and potentials of these countries. But for Iran, ECO is now even more important than before, because not only new administration of President Raisi counts very much on developing ties with the neighbors in order to improve the Iranian economy. For sure, that's one of the main ways to enhance economic, you know, interest and welfare of the people. But also, it also plays as part of Iran's main roadmap to defuse or lower the impact of the United States sanctions, which is, again, a major part of Iran's confrontation with the United States, as well as the talks between Iran and the U.S. and its allies. It depends very much on efficacy of the sanctions on both sides. Once the U.S. sees its main weapon of choice, that sanctions doesn't work properly or has lost its value and efficiency, then it would be more willing to strike a deal with Iran, unlike the present condition where the United States is still adamant to show any kind of flexibility. So developing ties with the neighbors and with the regional groupings like ECO is very much important for Iran from different aspects. Also, when you need water, a country like Iran needs lots of water supplies, facing drought or arid conditions because of the climate change, especially, and the need to water is somehow, you know, water supplies.
Well, stay with me, Mostafa. We're going to get into a little bit more of the specifics of what was talked about at the summit. But, John, the current government of Iran continues to reiterate, as Mostafa was saying, that it's prioritizing enhancing regional relations. I want to talk about the significance of that, that this government actually is not focusing on Western governments per se as its priority, but first priority is neighboring countries and enhancing that development. The significance of that?
Yeah, that significance goes beyond trade and resources. That is the significance that we obtain by having strength in numbers. As Iran develops its international relationships by making partners rather than colonies of other countries, as America does, Iran becomes an equal in trade and cooperation with other countries around it. And it brings an understanding of the Iranian situation to the fore in those other countries. And those other countries sit on the United Nations, and they can help Iran to evade the military pressures from the United States, the political efforts to do regime change in Iran. This is the main significance beyond the material, capital-driven significance of doing trade. And I want to remind people that the reason why many countries do not have good relations with their surrounding neighboring countries is greatly linked to capitalism and the pursuit of the cheapest product without any reference to the national interest. And here now Iran is making a bold new stake in exiting that system to trade with its neighbors and to build cooperation with its neighbors, which is with the primary initiative based on the interests of Iran and its neighbors. This brings you the strength in numbers with which you can use to defend yourself from unfair and illegal military pressures.
Well, John, you talked about as far as capitalism, but isn't also one of the policies of the United States is it's this divide, basically, and conquer type of mentality still, that to make sure that regional countries, especially this region, actually do not have that solidarity and that it does what it can to make sure that they never unite?
Absolutely. This comes from as far back and before the Roman Empire, when the policy of the empire was to divide and conquer. So the American aggressive stance towards Iran is focusing on dividing Iran from its first neighbors, from nations who know the Iranian people for thousands of years as their closest neighbors, dividing Iran from them, isolating Iran using sanctions, and then using the sanctions to weaken Iran internally and to try and create a fifth column inside Iran of Iranians who would act against their own national interests. Now, I think that's impossible for the United States to achieve given the solidarity of the Iranian people against American aggression and against America's link with Israel, which would rather see Iran destroyed than ever make peace with Iran.
Okay, Mostafa, I want to look at this and the importance of this front, if these countries could actually be united and independent of Washington's influence on it, and also the significance inside of the country that this current government, the Raisi administration, is prioritizing neighboring countries. I mean, what does it do as far as the Iranian psyche and knowing the importance of regional countries?
Well, you know, it's, as I just explained, it's in this government, for this government, expanding ties with the neighbors is high on the agenda. This doesn't mean that this government is going to be indifferent to the West or to the United States. In a balanced and a strategic roadmap of foreign policy, you need to have different plans and scenarios and, you know, roadmaps for even the hostile countries that are troubling you. And this doesn't mean that Iran is going to now look to the East and would never look for the West. As long as the United States leads the West, the Europeans are led by the U.S., and show hostility towards Iran and try to deceive Iran, then they do not show mutual respect. Iran would not go for them. But as soon as any of these countries, like Italy, like Greece, like Portugal, Spain, if they really, you know, show mutual respect or any further interest to develop ties and cooperation with Tehran, Tehran would be very much willing to expand ties with these countries. But there was a problem actually in the last one or two decades in Iran when some people thought that the only problem or the major problem is resolving the conflict with the United States and the Europeans. In order to expand ties with other nations, even those in the East, because the U.S. has developed some kind of hegemonic rule over these countries through dollar and its economic power. But throughout time, it was proved that their view was wrong, because even when Iran was under top sanctions, and it's still under toughening sanctions, in the last several months of President Rouhani's rule, Iran signed a free trade agreement, a major agreement, with Eurasian countries. And that proved that Iran has a lot of potentials to use in the region, in the neighboring states, in ties with China and Russia. And since the ECO member states, Shanghai member states, they knew that the next government in Iran would have a serious review of foreign policy and would go for real developing ties and cooperation with those in the East, they accelerated Iran's membership in the Shanghai Organization. So the agenda of this government, for many reasons, is that it really intends and plans to develop ties with the neighboring states, because Iran can enhance and boost its share of the market in countries like Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, or Afghanistan, CIS, the Caucasus, and even those on the southern rims of the Persian Gulf, to several times more in a period of 4 or 5 years.
Okay.
And then also, there are many potentials, intact potentials, in ties with China and Russia based on mutual respect, but I reemphasize that that doesn't mean that Iran is going to ignore the West. It would wait until the West realizes that it needs to approach Iran on the based on mutual respect and equal footing. That's actually why the Iranian top negotiator is in Vienna to reevaluate the U.S. and its European allies of real intentions.
All right, stay with me, Mostafa. Stay with me, Mostafa. John, your take on this, because we know that the U.S. has exerted so much pressure on Iran, and of course, more and more sanctions, it seems, every day. Despite this, do you think that overall that sanction regime has actually failed to isolate Iran as we're looking at this particular organization. And as Mostafa had just mentioned, a couple of other organizations Iran is a part of and expanding its relations with many of these countries. Do you see it as a failed policy, the sanction regime, and the ultimate goal of basically bringing Iran to its knees?
Well, first of all, obviously, Iran has not been brought to its knees. That's point number one. Point number two, having worked as a war correspondent and as a general reporter in the former Yugoslavia, in Russia, and in other areas of the world that have been put under U.S. sanctions, the result is always the same. Not only is the policy a failure, but the policy is a benefit. I know this sounds strange, but the policy is a benefit for the target nation, because the target nation who is unfairly and illegally placed under sanctions finds a will to work together with its neighbors and within its own population to develop a strength that it did not have previously, to develop a kind of immunity to the American empire. And the American empire then is powerless. And this is the actual result of sanctions, is that it makes the target nation stronger. The target nation finds that resources that might have been too expensive to develop locally are now worth the investment. And with that investment, the country is more independent than it ever was before. And as an independent country, it can then enter into real partnerships with equals, not a colonial relationship with the Anglo-American dictatorship.
Well, Mostafa, of course, one of the main mechanisms that the United States has used are dealing with financial transactions and controlling that. Looking at these countries, looking at these member countries that we're talking about from an economic perspective, how likely could it be that these countries could develop some type of alternative in dealing with financial transactions between each other in order to prohibit Washington from interfering?
Well, it's a difficult task, but it's possible. It's already been done. I mean, the Chinese have worked out several ways, the Russians also. Well, one of the first alternative ways or options that comes across anyone's mind is using a shared currency or a single currency. But this requires much time and effort. Sometimes such plans end up in nothing but failure. But a more possible way that has worked out for many nations, including Iran, is a foreign currency swap. Instead of using dollar, that has come to be the hegemonic currency, that is the common universal currency for the U.S. Pressures, under the U.S. pressures on oil-producing countries some 40, 50 years ago, after the oil shock by OPEC. Now, the countries have realized that much of the trade and transactions they are doing are working in the interest of the United States one way or another, because they do the deals in dollars, and the U.S. is using the same kind of instrument in order to harness them, in order to violate their sovereignty, their decision-making, their growth. Let's remember that the U.S. is trying to pressure Iran to stop growth in many areas like the nuclear industry and missile industry, regional power, and airman science. That's a decision, a sovereign decision, and they mean to violate it, and it's not acceptable to many independent countries. And they try to work out ways, different ways. One way that has been used is a foreign currency swap between two or among three nations. This has been done by the Chinese and the Russians in much of their trade transactions between Iran and some of its neighbors. It's been done in order to bypass the U.S. sanctions that include dollar sanctions, especially for Iran. And this has been a major way used by Iran and some other countries that are also under sanctions. We call them members of the Sanction Club of Nations. And sometimes you could do that through valuable metals like gold and other, you know, precious items and goods. Also, swap of goods is another way that has been underway, not only by Iran, but also many other nations that want to escape the dollar hegemonic rule over the economy, and also establishing an independent bank that's independent from the World Bank, because the World Bank, many of its officials and leaders, they are under, they are Americans, former U.S. officials, and the World Bank is operating under the, you know, a rule or influence, at least, of the United States, and it's pursuing the policies of the United States in imposing the sanctions and in, you know, harnessing and containing countries, target countries like Iran, like China and Russia and North Korea and Cuba and many others, at least continues for at least 30, 40 others more. So the Chinese have gone for establishing an alternative bank.
Right.
Actually, they have already made success in, you know, attracting the attention and investment and partnership of tens of other countries.
So are you saying the possibility that, sorry to interrupt, you're saying possibility of Iran joining in with that as far as the Chinese bank? Is that what you're saying, Mustafa?
Yes, because China.
Okay, that's good. That's all I need, because I'm running out of time. But let me just cross back over to John. Now, John, there are 10 countries which are members of this Economic Cooperation Organization: Afghanistan, Azerbaijan, Iran, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Pakistan, Tajikistan, Turkey, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan, with at least 470 million people. Looking at possibilities and the future of this, one thing we know that has taken place during this summit is that Iran, Turkmenistan, and Azerbaijan have agreed to swap 2 billion cubic meters of gas per year. The significance of such deals, and are you optimistic about the future of this organization?
Absolutely optimistic, and I also want to underline that I agree with your other guest today that the essence of the problem is in the use of the U.S. dollar, and it says in the Bible, give unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and the Caesar who's running this Anglo-American empire is the Federal Reserve Board that prints the worthless paper that we call dollars. And once you decide you want to be independent from the empire, you've got to stop using the empire's currency as the means of your existence. And I think that Iran is moving in that direction. I think Russia is moving in that direction. I think China is moving in that direction, and much of Africa, because there is no reason why a small secret group of banksters, as we call them in the West, should be allowed to print toilet paper, which you are forced to use to trade among yourselves.
Okay. And on that note, I appreciate you being with us, both of you, Mostafa Khoshpesh, journalist and political commentator out of Iran, John Busness, journalist and political analyst out of Switzerland. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Hope to see you right here.